I wanted to welcome you to the Counseling and Psychological Services at George Mason University's podcast series, where we're going to be interviewing various campus departments and stakeholders, and we can kind of shed some light on what we do here at George Mason. We're lucky today to have Dr. Ha with us.
I'm Dr. Gloria Ha, a staff psychologist at CAPS.
Dr. Ha, when you think of barriers in terms of accessing services here at CAPS at George Mason, what tends to come up for you?
Basically, barriers are like things that prevent people who are in need of services to not actually use them, right? And I think the main one to me, what I've seen in the work that I've done, is people not knowing what to expect. And what that does is there's a lot of ambiguity or like not knowing. And when people don't know, what they do is they don't choose. And what they do is just stay in this state of ambivalence. So a lot of times when I talk to people, it's mostly like, I don't know. Are you going to think I'm crazy? Or am I going to go to the hospital? Like, are people going to find out? It's going to be on my record. Like all these things, right? So then if they don't know what even counseling is about, then they're not going to choose to come. They're going to be like, why?
How do you typically explain to folks kind of what counseling entails and what are some of the factors that you make sure to get across to people?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's one thing that's really unique about me is, like, I actually love when people don't want to be with me. And so I spend a lot of time in the beginning explaining what counseling is. So all the misconceptions, right? Like, I'm not here to tell you that you're crazy. A lot of the things that are, like, the reasons why you're stressed might be related to these certain things. Counseling is not just me sitting and listening to you, because I would not charge you just to listen. So I was like, if someone's doing that, then it's not really counseling. So I talked to them about, like, what the process looks like, what I'm looking for, what I'm thinking about them, and what the end result potentially could be. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm like, hey, are you game? If they are, then we continue. If not, then they're like, all right, I choose not to. And then right. I give them that autonomy to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. For folks that have never been to counseling before, how would you describe some of the issues that you might see come up?
Well, I think I was talking to you about how I notice a lot of people who don't know about counseling, when they end up coming to counseling, they're actually more severe in terms of symptomatology. And that's because they're like, I don't want to go. I'm using all these other ways to kind of get these needs met, and they're not. So they just pile up. And then they come to us when they're like, you're my last resort. I don't know what the hell this is, but in the end, maybe this is a chance for me to, like, feel better. So it's a lot of high, severe crisis cases that really need a lot more attention, unfortunately, than someone who's more familiar with counseling that come. They're like, oh, I'm depressed a little bit. I'm anxious. I'm stressed. You're like, oh, okay, that's great. But then most people who are, like, in crisis, they're like, I've thought about killing myself for a year. Mm-hmm. And I'm, like, getting things in order. Mm-hmm. And I see that a lot, especially in marginalized populations as well as populations of color, because a lot of times they're not very familiar with the whole concept of counseling or mental health. They're used to, culturally, they're used to suppressing or toughing it out or finding other ways to kind of deal rather than talking to someone. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Ha, when thinking about some of the populations that you're describing, when you've seen that show up in the room here, what's that look like, particularly when seeking out counseling or talking to a professional is taboo?
What I've noticed is that a lot of times if you come from a background, and it doesn't always have to be like populations of color. I mean, there are a lot of different family structures that have created a way that relationally you don't express your feelings. You don't make sense of your feelings. You just kind of suppress, right? So a lot of times they're actually not aware of their emotions. So you literally have to start from scratch. You have to explain to them that it was actually protective for you to be the way you are. And you have to honor that because it kind of aligns with culturally how they grew up, is to suppress. Like, that's how they survived. That's how their family survived, especially in really stressful situations. Like, you can't emote in trauma. Like, you can't. Your body protectively puts it aside so that you can survive. So you help them understand that it's actually like a protective thing for them, but it's also not working. So we help them to have compassion on their like lack of ability to understand and express their emotions, and work towards like how we can make them like have a better relationship with their feelings and expressing their emotions that doesn't feel like they're kind of going against their cultural values that they grew up with.
Dr. Hutt, seems like multiculturalism is a significant and important facet of the work that you do. If you could speak to what some of the diversity factors that you've seen here at Mason, what that's been like for you, and how you integrate this component into your work.
Working with diverse populations is extremely rewarding, but also very, what's the word? You never know what to expect when you meet with people.
Because complexity.
There's a lot of complexity, but there's a lot of unknown. And I do well. I thrive in those kinds of situations because I believe in a collaborative approach. So I don't need to be an expert. You come in the room and we together explore together, right? But I know a lot of people can feel uncomfortable about this, especially if you come from like traditional backgrounds, like, oh, you have to have this approach and you work with specific people with this way of dealing with anxiety, depression. But in this university, you never really know how anxiety is manifesting, their thought process, like what cultural values are like they're stuck with that are making it difficult for them to move forward. So it's just really interesting how like creative you have to be when you work with diverse populations. So I'm always on my feet, which I think is fun and rewarding because I feel like I'm refining my ability to really connect with clients and really understand how to provide counseling that's culturally competent. And not do some cookie cutter approach that really doesn't fit with a diverse group of clients.
And Dr. Huck, can you speak to maybe what the fear of what coming to CAPS might mean for some diverse groups?
Well, given that the population here that I've worked with, a lot of times where I'm working with clients of color, right? And we have these discussions of the fear of what to expect when you come here. And I mean, there's so much research that talks about, you know, the association with medical professionals and just the stimulus value of white culture and having psychopathologized marginalized identities in practice, right? So that, of course, trickles down to mental health professionals as well. So we're talking about people who are scared, like literally scared, having panic attacks before coming because they don't know what to expect. And they're scared of not specifically just a medical professional. They're scared of meeting a white professional that will judge them, that will name them as, you know, crazy or whatever, and also screw them over in terms of the next step. So a lot of times, a lot of the fear is like, am I going to be hospitalized? Is this going to be on my record? And like, I'll never get a job. Like, those are the things that really have a lot of stimulus value that actually create a lot of stress. And they don't have the freedom to talk about it, so which is even more unfortunate. I mean, I'm fortunate because I can have these conversations, but I have to name it. I can't expect them to name it for me because we're in positions of power. So having these.
So by naming this in some of your work with clients, what does that do for them? I would imagine that it enables a trusting relationship.
Well, trust is to me gold, right? And I think that trust is earned and it's not assumed for me to have, right? And I think that they think that I'm assuming that they have to trust me. So if I don't name it and put it on the table, like, hey, I know I'm a stranger. I know you have I have no idea about you, and there's a lot of things that you might fear. I'm here to earn your trust. And one of the ways, especially when you're working with trauma and when you're working with people from marginalized identities, the honesty and genuineness is key. If you don't name things, there will be distorted assumptions that will be made about you, and those will be the things that they kind of that direct their next steps. And so for me, since I know that, I'm like, okay, what can I name and what can I specifically say that I think is a barrier for us to, you know, build a trusting relationship and then capitalize on that.
Can you please speak to some of the things that you enjoy the most about working at CAPS?
I think the things that I enjoy about CAPS is, it's interesting because we complain a lot about the limited resources that we have here. But I think having the small number of clinicians, but we also have a lot of autonomy to do the things that we want to do. And we get to, you know, build on the things we're passionate about. So for me, I'm really interested in family of origin issues. So I can run a group, I can do it in my clinical work. You know, I know you, Derek, you have like an interest in sports psychology and like all that. And so you get to kind of do that. And I think that if it's like a huge organization, there might not be as flexibility. We have more autonomy to do things. And I think we have a lot of flexibility. Like our system is changing all the time. So if you're constantly able to like, to assess, oh, this isn't working, let's change it. Like that helps us to really listen to what clients in the community need, in the student community, and then we can adjust and refine our services to meet their needs.
I know you spoke about there being a wide variety of different treatment options and modalities here at CAPS, as well as different provider personalities. And if you could speak to some of those.
Yeah, I think the assumption is that, you know, there's only one type of counselor at the counseling center. And I think we have so many different personalities that you can actually ask for. And so I love that because, I mean, everyone has a different preference. So you can come, and if you want to do more cognitive behavioral stuff, you can do that. If you want to deal with more process-oriented stuff, you can do that. If you want to do it in individual or group or like workshop where you don't even need to talk to the person, like there's so many different ways that you can do stuff. And we have so much access. Like if you really demanded a service, you probably could be seen that day, right? And so I think people are not aware that, you know, in the community, there's a huge lag of time in terms of getting connected to services. But here, we're kind of quick. One of the things that I noticed at this university is that there's a lot of people who are in financial need, either not having insurance or, you know, working a job as well as, you know, paying for tuition and going to school full time. So, you know, it's not feasible for them to go out in the community and pay like $200 for a session. So when they come here, it's like they are more thankful for just, you know, even getting the short-term counseling services that we do provide, which is awesome.
And as we've seen, you know, nationally with some of the trends that are out there, a lot of students are coming to college with pre-existing mental health concerns and are presenting to counseling centers in crises.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I don't really even know what to say about it. We basically specialize in dealing with crisis situations, right? And I mean, there's a wide array, but if you want to look at specifically I think every single person at our center is so comfortable with suicidality, you know, trauma, what else? Homicidal ideation. I mean, like, we just have so much familiarity with this that, you know, when you come here, you'll get good care because you're going to meet with someone who can be, like, stable and sit with you in that and not judge you. So I think that is really important because a lot of people in the community usually are not as familiar with crisis interventions. So if you are in need of it, then come here. Our comfort in knowing the nuances of crisis intervention is so important because every case is different. Even if like their symptoms of suicidality are the same, the context is so different, and if you aren't aware of how to make sense of it or conceptualize a treatment plan for the client, it just isn't worth their time, and we do that so quickly. And so I think that is something that I feel really proud of at our center, that we all can do that in such a quick amount of time, and we literally save lives.
As a CAPS clinician and staff psychologist here, how might you respond to maybe potential negative perceptions that CAPS has on campus or within the campus community?
Whenever people say those things about how we don't have a good reputation, most people respond defensively, saying, no, we're actually great. And my approach is actually different. I come from a place of humility. It's like, yes, we're part of a system. The system actually sucks. And there are a lot of flaws. And the more that we hear you and more that we hear how we need to improve, I think that that's actually like a gift to us. So when I hear that we're not that welcoming and we're not that, I don't know, culturally competent, I actually think it's a gift. And so I don't get defensive. I'm like, oh, great. I need to know a little bit more. It's nice to be aware of like the limitations and just sit with it. You don't have to defensively explain that we're so great. That actually goes against helping people connect to us. Because if you're pretending, if you're putting on a face that you're actually perfect, no one's going to believe it. And literature shows that all the time. So why don't we just acknowledge that we actually have a lot of room for growth? And there are a lot of limitations, and we're trying our best to work on those things and really respect that they had the courage to give us that feedback. Mm-hmm. So that's the very different approach from how politically we usually approach criticism, because I know that a lot of higher-ups are like, no, we're really culturally competent. I'm like, well, that's not really helpful. It doesn't really, there's no data to support that, and there's, that's not listening to the voices of who are the most important, which is people in the community that want to get connected to us.
Dr. Hub, what keeps you doing the work here at CAPS at Mason?
So what keeps me doing the work is it's a calling. It's not a job. And so the reason why I got into the field was I grew up seeing a lot of people in my community. And when I talk about community, I say my Korean immigrant community that I grew up in, having so many mental health issues and having nowhere to go, and seeing a lot of people just pretty much like basically fall apart before my eyes. And then I worked in like really reputable places, and I noticed that a lot of populations of color, especially who are in need of services, actually didn't get connected. There were reasons that were preventing them from actually, even if it was free, they wouldn't seek services. And so to me, it started to spark a curiosity of like, okay, I know counseling helps. Why are people not getting connected? And how can I be a resource to make sure that whatever way, shape, or form, I can be a part of this movement that helps people who are in pain getting healing? So it's more of like a calling. That's why I say it's not like I wouldn't be doing for the salary if I did it for that, because I could have totally gone into like a lot of different professions. But it just felt like it really tapped into like a life value for me and social justice, the way I perceive it. So I mean, I don't know how other people perceive their own way of living social justice, but for me is like the number one thing is I want to start righting some wrongs. And I think that counseling is definitely one of those avenues that I feel like I can do that.
How would you describe some of your own values in terms of, like you just said, righting some of those wrongs that are present in your work?
You know, the number one thing I think I do is on an individual level, I instill hope. So I think with a lot of clients, they come in thinking like, there's no hope for me. I'm too messed up. This world is too messed up. And I'm like, yeah, like shit is real. And I feel that, but at the same time, there's always room for hope. And so I get them to spark their curiosity and really knowing what can they do to like, to stop being disempowered and internalizing all that oppression onto like them being the fault of whatever oppression that they've experienced, whether it's abuse, whether it's systemic oppression, whatever it is, right? And I get them to think critically of like, how is that actually false and how can we speak truth? And when they start to realize their inner worthiness, their hope for something different starts to increase. And I think that that's like the start of their journey of like really becoming more free. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this like instill hope that will potentially lead to more freedom for them to like live the ways that they want to live.
What would be a message that you might give to a prospective client who's a little bit hesitant about coming in to receive services?
If I were to try to convince somebody who is hesitant to come, I would say there is no pressure. I understand your hesitance. I was there once before. And guess what? It is scary. But I will be there with you. I will sit there. I will earn your trust. Try, at least. And my main goal is to make sure that you see yourself differently and that you start to have hope to live a more fulfilling life. And so I think I want to acknowledge, like, it's uncomfortable. Like, it's going to be, like, scary. Like, you can get mad at me. I can deal. But I'll be in it with you. And, I mean, I say this with my clients all the time. I'm like, I'm your number one fan. Like, the more I get to know you, the more I like you. And I can't wait to see how to get to know you more and how for you to see that it's possible that someone could really know you and still think that you're amazing just the way you are. And I think that that is something that is very unique because people become really vulnerable with me. And then I can use that to help them to see that it's great. It's not like the monster that they think that they are, which comes from a lot of times like internalized messages from their past. So sure. I'm Dr. Gloria Ha, a staff psychologist at CAPS.